Hello and welcome to episode 144 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control, and on this week's episode we have Commander Andrea Cameron of the United States Naval War College to talk about humanitarian assistance. We talk about the spectrum of different humanitarian operations, the interagency nature of those missions, and how the Navy and the armed forces fit in. We will get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SIMSEC brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
And we're back. As I mentioned at the top, I'm here with Commander Andrea Cameron of the United States Naval War College. Andrea, thank you very much for being with us on Sea Control today.
Thank you, Matt.
So, as is Sea Control tradition, please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are now.
I had a very unique career. I was a surface warfare officer for 7 years. I was stationed on a big deck amphib, an aircraft carrier. And then I was a human resources officer in the Navy for about 10 years. And I specialized in education, training, and development. And after that, I was selected as a permanent military professor. When I joined the Navy back in the 90s, post-Cold War, we did a variety of military operations other than war. And I was fascinated at the time how the military could respond to such a variety of contingencies in short order. So my particular interest is humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. When I was selected as a permanent professor, they let me study whatever I wanted within the security studies field, so I chose kind of a mix of international relations theory and political science and apply that specifically to my topic of humanitarian assistance disaster relief.
So you mentioned that term permanent military professor a couple of times in your intro. What is that role? How did you get selected for it? What are the benefits and drawbacks, and how did you get to be in that particular role?
So it's a permanent military professor is a lateral transfer. If you're selected, the Navy funds a PhD program for you, and then your obligated service is basically the rest of your career through statutory retirement while you're serving as a professor at one of the Navy's educational institutions. It's a very small community. We have about 80 billets, and 4 of them are at the Naval Postgraduate School, 3 are currently at the Naval War College, and the rest of them are all at the Naval Academy.
So there's a lot of them down at the Naval Academy then.
The majority of the program is run out of the Naval Academy.
So what do you have to do to become a PMP?
The community is primarily open to the unrestricted line and the Information Warfare Corps, but other restricted lines can be considered. Every year there's a NAV admin that comes out that says what fields of study we are trying to find people for. And when that time comes, be ready. A lot of people say that a permanent military professor, when I tell them what I do, man, I hear, that's my dream job, or I want to do that. So I usually give out 2 general pieces of advice. 1, advance in your designator. To be a permanent military professor, you have to be an O5 or an O5 select. And they do that because you kind of hit the sweet spot at that junior O5 level. You have enough time to get a PhD and also do a lot of years of teaching at one of the institutions. And the second one piece of advice that I give everyone is to really think of your academic future. If this is what you want to do and you want to get selected as a PMP, and you have to be accepted into a PhD program. A lot of years there are stellar applicants into the program, but if you don't have a undergrad and a master's degree kind of in your field that have really good grades that would let you be admitted into a PhD program, then that's kind of a roadblock. You can't be selected as a professor if we can't get you into a PMP program. So if you're one of those junior officers out there and think that you'd like to do this someday, really think long-term about your academic future and build the record that would really shine when your opportunity comes.
So that actually sounds like, as you mentioned, a pretty sweet deal. Are there any drawbacks to being a PMP? Because that sounds pretty fantastic.
It is. I won't lie. I'm living the dream job. The primary drawback is there's definitely a lack of upward mobility. When you're doing this, you're most likely a Terminal 05. Everyone would love to be considered for those handful of 06 positions, but when you get picked up, you acknowledge up front in the application that there's limited career progression And it's driven, as every other community, by the needs of the Navy and the PMP requirements. So that's the primary drawback.
Oh, so let's talk then a little bit about what it's like being a PMP in terms of your research. So obviously mentioned at the top, Commander Andrew Cameron, so sitting military officer as a part of the PMP. But then your field of study that you've kept consistent through those different phases has been development and humanitarianism, which let's just say for most military, you know, members is probably atypical. So what brought you to study those particular fields and how has that gone so far?
It's going well. I work at the Naval War College, and fortunately, they allow you to study every field that can be related to national security interests. Why do I study these? Because I tend to take a broader view of what national security interests are. A lot of times you'll hear that 4+1 construct, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and the violent extremists. And that construct works really well. With those threats, you can identify a country, a place on a map, a leader, a governance system, their capabilities, and you can figure out what you want to do to counteract that. And fortunately, there are thousands of people around the world who study this very in depth. I look at national security interests differently. As a country with global interests politically, economically, and ideologically, there are a lot of national security issues that aren't covered under this 4+1 construct. I like one of my favorite phrases, threats without enemies. And if you look at a variety of human security issues, they are threats without enemies, and they're going to affect our national security interests in the future.
So that sounds like a bit about, you know, the ideas behind human security that we hear about inside the security realm nowadays. Even, you know, schools like Fletcher will be teaching human security issues in the midst of the traditional security studies classes because it's become such an integral part of kind of the community's view on things. So could you give us some examples of how those, you know, threats without enemies manifest? Like, are there ones that are kind of top of mind for you that you think would resonate with our audience?
Sure. Human security is often described in the inverse, in the insecurities of individuals, not states. You often hear about economic insecurity, food insecurity, or health or environmental insecurity. Those are all broad topics that fall under human security. Within this, there's a laundry list of things that are covered. Global climate change, food and water scarcity, poverty, urbanization, mass migration, epidemics. All of that falls under this kind of broad umbrella of human security issues. And some of these may not touch us directly, but they're definitely going to start affecting our partners and allies around the world. So I definitely think that this is a good approach to looking at national security issues.
So if this is a good approach, how then does the United States sort of operationalize that in foreign policy? What does that mean? Are there certain, you know, tweaks and ways that we do things differently from the past that allows us to, you know, to go after these sorts of threats without enemies? Or how does that all work?
We tend to look at our foreign policy in this 3D construct. And if you're not familiar with the 3Ds, they're defense, diplomacy, and development. And that has evolved over the years. For a long time, defense has been naturally your military arm or your hard power, and diplomacy and development are more of this soft power. And this can get rolled up into a formula that combines the two, and they often call it smart power. These are very important things to consider because you want to have a balance, and that's something that's very hot in the language today with how these organizations are changing. The military, the DOD, is naturally in charge of the defense D, and State Department is the lead on diplomacy. And the United States Agency for International Development has the lead for all development and humanitarian efforts of the United States government.
And so that's the construct as it stands now. How is that evolving and changing under the current administration? Is it going to be a lot of more of the same? Are there tweaks that are being talked about? I know that in the news there was talked about maybe putting USAID back under State Department. What kind of do you see as the long-term trajectory of that kind of bureaucratic organizational system that currently comprises the 3Ds?
This is a great discussion. It's come out in a lot of places. First is the discussion by the administration of expanding the Defense Department and wanting to pay for it through the budget proposal that the president put forward. In that budget proposal was increases to defense, and massive cuts to State Department and USAID. It's still to be determined whether this is going to happen, if Congress is going to execute the president's budget as it was submitted, which is probably not likely that it will cut State and USAID to such a great degree. However, we see Secretary Tillerson in State Department already reducing personnel, reforming the institution, and taking away some of the programs that have long-term development of Foreign Service officers. And that's all, of course, in accordance with the president's vision of where State should be going. USAID, it's to be determined. They just confirmed Ambassador Mark Green as to lead the USAID, and he recently testified before Congress. Slightly different approach to development, which is much more of a hand-up, not a hand-out perspective. Nothing wrong with that. But what was reassuring was his language about humanitarian efforts in the future. So that's kind of the current status of under the new president, and I'll probably talk about that a little bit more as we discuss some of the topics coming up.
So you've used a lot of terms so far that I think many of our audience is familiar with, at least on a, you know, on a basic level, but I know that they don't all mean the same things. So you've mentioned development, you've also mentioned humanitarianism and humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. There are a lot of different sort of layers to this. So I was wondering if you could walk us through some of those terms now that we've got kind of the baseline. What is the difference between, you know, development, humanitarianism, and disaster relief, and how does that kind of sort of pop up in your studies?
Development is the broad category, and most of our foreign aid and assistance falls under the development category. Development is basically when one state or actor helps to improve another's economic, health, government, social well-being, anything that you're trying to do. By its very nature, it's inherently political. The United States government is working with another actor to help them out. And of course, when you're doing that, there's this natural belief that it's what's in it for the United States government. There are 14 different agencies that use foreign aid and assistance. DOD is just one, State, USAID, they all have lines of accounting for this. In FY16, it was about a $36 billion budget, and it affects 142 countries around the world. So we were talking about what does slashing this in the budget impact. It involves a lot of U.S. government agencies and a lot of countries that we work with. The military does development, it usually does it through security cooperation or military to military. We do some infrastructure building, we do some global health engagement, but a lot of what the military does is through security cooperation, through exercises, through education and exchange programs, institution building. Those types of activities give a really good example of what the military is doing for development.
All right, so that's development. So how is that different from humanitarianism?
Humanitarianism has a completely different mindset. Humanitarian actors provide aid for saving lives and alleviating suffering. With this, they have some governing principles. They operate under the principles of humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and operational independence. Those principles kind of govern everything they do. They take them very, very seriously. Everything about their identity, their effectiveness, their safety and authority all derives from these principles. What's different about governments and militaries is that we cannot be neutral and we're not going to be impartial. This is also what makes them different from development agencies. Because of this, the non-governmental organizations don't want to blur the lines primarily by working with militaries. The international humanitarian governance from the United Nations and the United Nations and the non-governmental organizations, they all reflect this preference for the humanitarian principles. And as such, working with the military is what they call the last resort.
So if there is that big of a difference between development and humanitarianism, and it seems like there is that underlying friction then between the humanitarian community and the military, why then did you decide to focus on humanitarian assistance as the field that you wanted to focus on for your PMP?
I focus on humanitarian assistance largely because I believe there isn't a conflict that doesn't have a corresponding humanitarian crisis. And often whatever is driving the humanitarian crisis is probably the root cause of the conflict. If you look at those escalating human security issues we touched on earlier, urbanization, food and water scarcity, mass migration, I think the logical conclusion is that we will see more conflicts like this in the future. And if you don't address the root causes of conflict, you won't find a way to end the conflict. So I look at it this way, so that as my contribution to the study of war.
And so let's dive then deeper into, you know, the, you know, you think that there is a way to reconcile, you know, the military component and the humanitarian assistance component, since they're, you know, intertwined and whatnot. But let's talk about those actors, between the humanitarian actors and militaries. Go into a little bit more detail about, you know, what that friction is, how it manifests, and what that, how that affects sort of the battle space.
So I mentioned the international humanitarian governments. It was all developed back in the post-Cold War 1990s at the height of humanitarian intervention missions. So the military's role in these type of humanitarian interventions was still the use of force. Although we've labeled it humanitarian, we were not being impartial, we were not being neutral, and we were trying to end violence through the use of force. The military was, in fact, not being a humanitarian actor. And these various events, you might remember Somalia, Bosnia, Rwanda, Kosovo, and we had varied levels of engagements and varied levels of results. But in the context of civil-military coordination, it was all developed during this time. Militaries and humanitarians, they work in the same geographic space. But back then, we tried much harder to segregate. You work on this side, and I'll work on this side of the humanitarian space. And if we can, you know, we'll just stay out of each other's way as much as possible. And this helped, you know, reaffirm the humanitarian principles for the humanitarian actors, and it helped mission completion for the military actors. Also during this, if the military is being, in essence, a belligerent, the NGOs are not compromising their values, and they are not ultimately compromising their mission or their safety. So they really like to segregate as much as possible. This has evolved a lot over the years, and basically the concept of having separate spaces, it no longer exists. The collapse of the humanitarian space forces the non-governmental organizations and the militaries to work together much more closely. And a great example of this is in Iraq and Syria today, where you get the military operating CENTCOM is working with USAID. And they're trying to deconflict. That's the word, these are deconfliction efforts. So that the NGOs can, if they're willing to cooperate, provide us some information about where they are so that we cannot be operating in the same space or be operating at least with some understanding of where they're working so we can avoid each other.
And so, you know, you've mentioned sort of the historical foundation of this. You mentioned a bit about how it works in Iraq and Syria. Do you see any other changes happening in that relationship as time goes on, since clearly that immediate post-Cold War relationship of segregation to where we are now is very, very different? Do you see that as continuing to change, or are we at kind of a state of equilibrium right now where people know what the swim lanes are and they know how to interact with one another?
No, we don't know where the swim lanes are. We're constantly evolving this practice, and the governance still largely remains the same. Of course, the humanitarian principles guide the humanitarian actors, but their willingness to work around and with the military is evolving somewhat, just for their own safety. There is more and more attacks on humanitarian workers. Security has become such an issue for them that how they view the military and how they can partner with the military, that's just a constantly evolving thing, and we shall see where it goes in the future.
So we talked about development. We've talked now about humanitarianism, but there's also the third aspect, the second half of HADR, a term that most people already know, which is the disaster relief element. So how does the instance of a flood or a hurricane or an earthquake change the dynamics between the relief community and the military, and how the military gets involved in those kinds of things? Is it the same? Is it different? What are sort of the rules of engagement on that front?
So this is what I find most fascinating about the natural disaster component, because this sudden onset crisis really brings the humanitarian imperative to the front. You want to help as many people to do these humanitarian missions of save lives and alleviate suffering. So whoever the host nation or affected state invites to assist is doing that. They are there to save lives and alleviate suffering. Counter to everything I just explained, in many countries, the military has actually evolved as a first responder within their own country, or even a lot of bilateral agreements have been set up that a partner country agrees if there is a natural disaster, a partner country will supply these kind of military resources. So that's counter to everything I just said because of the different context of a natural disaster. Now, keep in mind, the non-governmental organizations still may resist working with the militaries, but the larger the scale of the event, I mean, they want to help people and they need the resources that they didn't need yesterday. So this entire notion of being in a disaster, it kind of upends the governance, the rules, the norms, and it changes the notion of what can be done with civil-military coordination. This isn't just true for humanitarians. It also upends military norms. We've, you know, in the military, we have the mindset that we're here to break things and kill people. And in the flash of an event, we're now here to build things and save people. So this isn't something Clausewitz has laid the groundwork for previously. But to answer the really big question is, why does this topic matter? Because we, the military, we are doing this now, and we're going to keep doing it in the future. So the nature of warfare is changing, what you can do with the military is changing, and we'll all be better by giving this certain activity some more attention.
So the U.S. military is involved in humanitarian disaster relief missions, but you also specifically mentioned that there are other countries where the military isn't just an actor, but the primary first responder. So from your research, which countries are currently configured that way, where the military is the first responder? And consequently, which ones of those that are configured that way do you find do the best job and maybe the model best worth emulating either by the United States or by others?
I think of two examples, and unfortunately, there are countries that deal with these events quite frequently. One that is very obvious is the Philippines. They get typhoons quite regularly, and they have a very robust internal emergency management system, and they actually just train military and emergency managers routinely so that they can be prepared for the next event. Another example I think of is Chile. And they have earthquakes quite frequently, occasionally with tsunamis, and the military is also a first responder down there. That is probably the poster child of how to do it right.
So those countries are configured with, you know, specifically dedicated units and peoples and processes and whatnot. But for the United States, how then, with our configuration, does the military get involved in HADR missions? Like, what's the process? Since a lot of people here have some operational experience, like, how does the tasking orders work? Like, who ends up being in charge? How does the military then get looped into HADR missions from the U.S. context?
There's two pieces of this. There's the formal kind of process, and then there's what's happening and everyone working together. So formally, there's an event, the host nation goes to the ambassador, so State Department routes it up through the Secretary of State and the President. Can we assist this country? They've formally asked for our help. If the government wants to do that, of course, the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, responds, and the DOD might be tasked as a supporting unit to them. While all of that is happening, of course, you know, we watch the news. We know there's an event. There is a geographic combatant commander who's working with the embassy on the ground, who's already working probably with the USAID people on the ground. And they're all setting this up so that when the formal guidance comes, the operational orders come, we're ready to do it. There is, because it is a natural disaster, there's a small window of opportunity for any geographic combatant commander. They have 72 hours. While all of this formal stuff is happening, the geographic combatant commander has a 72-hour window to save lives and alleviate suffering. And what they're doing is possibly redirecting their forces, plotting out some logistics, setting up their staffs, task organizing, whatever they're doing to get ready so that when the order comes, they're already in action. The size of the response can be anything from a single ship to a joint task force. Or you might recall the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami, where the joint task force quickly evolved into a combined support force, where other militaries were working with us to support the humanitarian assistance. I want to just quickly mention internationally, as soon as an event happens, it's not just the U.S. government that responds, but there is an international humanitarian system that responds, led by the United Nations agencies, specifically the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. And they have a robust cluster system that provides coordination. They also set up coordination cells for mill-to-mill cooperation and for civilian-military coordination. And it's through this broader network that both USAID and the supporting Department of Defense resources would all plug into.
One of the things that I've noticed and that we've talked about before is that there is a change in the Navy and the Sea Services strategy, the Cooperative Strategy for 21st Century Sea Power, from the 2007 version that had HADR as a core capability, but then it was changed where it wasn't considered a core capability in the 2015 version. Could you talk a little bit then about how current Navy and Sea Service strategy addresses the HADR mission?
So the HADR mission has now been placed under power projection, and it's the same assets and capabilities of kind of ship-to-shore movement that is wrapped up into power projection, which is why HADR kind of was removed as a core capability, but still something very important to one of our primary missions, which is power projection. It's very interesting to see how this has developed over time. HADR is something listed specifically in the QDR. It's been mentioned in the National Security Strategy. Given that it was already kind of placed underneath power projection in the most recent security strategy, I think that will carry through even with the new administration. I don't think it's something that's going away. I just think it will actually be something that kind of stays core to our mission, but probably underneath the power projection category.
So if it's not going anywhere, I imagine then it would probably make sense for the people listening then to get even smarter on the topic than you've already made us in this interview. So for those people that are out there, especially I imagine since they'll be doing the coordination, the officers that are out there, do you have any recommendations on how people can learn more about this topic and what sorts of sources they should dive into, since it is sort of an atypical field of study for most people, either in the humanitarian space or inside the military space?
There's two particular training opportunities that I'd recommend to anyone interested in the subject. First, in Hawaii, there's the Center for Excellence for Disaster Management and Humanitarian Assistance. They have a fantastic course. They call it the HART course, H-A-R-T, Humanitarian Assistance Response Training. And if you cannot get to Hawaii, they have wonderfully put this online through JKO, the Joint Knowledge Online. So it's the HART course, JKO, and anyone can take that with a CAT card. The second opportunity, the USAID military liaison teams put together the Joint Humanitarian Operations course. They teach it to us, and they travel around to different military commands, the ones most likely to be doing this type of work. And they give you the basics on the USAID DOD relationship, and how in operations we work together. So if you ever get an opportunity to sit in on what they call the JHOC course, Joint Humanitarian Operations course, it's a fantastic opportunity and extremely valuable.
So for those officers and enlisted and people out there in the services that don't have the opportunity to take any of those courses, what would you say then is the biggest takeaway for them, so that if they get put into a situation where they need to know about HADR, that they can be at the very least literate in what's going on?
So most importantly, just remember that the military is a short-term piece of a very large-scale response, and we're only there for a little bit of time until the civilian response capabilities can be fully established, and then we're out. And also remember that there's the USAID, they're the lead agency, and if we do this, we are supporting them. There's much less of them than us, but they are the lead agency when we do humanitarian assistance disaster relief.
Well, since it seems like we're getting towards the end of our interview, We'll end it the same way we do all the other episodes. Tell us a little bit about what you're reading and what kinds of resources and sort of articles are capturing your attention nowadays.
I'm participating in the Women, Peace, and Security Conference at the Naval War College, and I'm reading a book right now by Rosa Brooks. She previously worked as the counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense, and she wrote a great book on how everything became war and the military became everything. It really shines a light on all the ways that war and everything else we do that's not war has been blurred in modern warfare. So it's a fascinating book. And the second thing I'm reading right now is unpublished, but it should be published in the next year. It's a book called How Navies Fight and Win at Sea by Jeff Karas and Tony Cowden. And it really provides an in-depth modernization to naval operational art. It draws on a rich operations research background, and then it pulls in kind of the prolific Navy thinkers like Fisk and Wiley and Wayne Hughes. And I think this book, How Navies Fight and Win at Sea, will be kind of a future classic. So no doubt it will show up on SimSec when it gets published. Fantastic work.
I'm looking forward to giving that one a read at some point. Well, thank you again, Andrea, so much for your time. Appreciate you sharing insights into this unique topic in the military space. And best of luck with your research. And thank you very much for being with us on Sea Control today.
Thank you, Matt.
That concludes episode 144 of the Sea Control podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our guest this week, Commander Andrea Cameron, and our producer for this episode, Ryan Yulia. If you enjoyed this episode, but you haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time on Sea Control.